Good morning, Old Mole listeners. This is Norm Diamond, acting as your book mole today. I'm going to do something a bit unusual in the course of this morning's program, review two books that are related only in that they are political and written, both of them, for middle school readers. Let me repeat that. For our sophisticated Old Mole listeners, I'm going to call your attention to two books geared to 12-year-olds. One of the books is a graphic novel relating the experience of Guatemalan immigrants in the U.S. now to the decades-long struggle of indigenous people in Guatemala that culminated in peace accords in the mid-1990s, but that, in fact, continues in less military forms today. The other is a book-length history of working people in the United States, starting with Columbus's arrival. Both books were sent to me to evaluate by terrific teacher organizations with which I'm proud to associate, Teaching for Change and the Zinn Education Project, develop and provide classroom materials, offer workshops for teachers on how to teach Black history, the Palestinian struggle, and many other important and controversial topics, and offer scholarships and training for outstanding teachers toward working with others in their schools and communities in developing new curricula and classroom materials. The Zinn Education Project is a joint effort with Rethinking Schools, an outstanding quarterly journal in which teachers write in depth about their experiences, for instance, working with transgender students or resisting efforts by right-wing groups to censor their classrooms or using poetry to enable students to examine their own lives or bring students from different backgrounds together. The three organizations, Teaching for Change, Zinn Education Project, and Rethinking Schools, together reach about 200,000 teachers nationally, with many participants throughout Oregon and Washington, and annual conferences between our two states that draw hundreds. The first book, Silenced Voices, by Pablo León, is powerful and a delight. I recommend it without reservation to interested adults as well as high school and middle school students. As I mentioned, it's a graphic novel, and it uses that form effectively to tell an important and moving story. The story's frame is the experience of two Guatemalan indigenous schoolboys living in the United States whose mother has never told them much about how and why they came to be living here. That silence is common among immigrant families. My grandparents, too, never talked about their life in the old country. The younger boy is prompted to question that silence, even though ridiculed by his older brother, who initially doesn't understand the importance of his heritage. The older brother's perspective will change as he learns from his younger sibling. Much of the story is told through the experience of their mother as a young girl, what happens to her, her family and friends, the destruction of their village by Guatemalan government forces, her difficult flight, and how she ends up here. In the early 1980s, with Guatemala under military rule, more than 400 villages of people of Mayan ancestry were obliterated by military attack, with tens of thousands killed and hundreds of thousands forced into internal exile or escape abroad. The mother's story is one of danger, horrors, and remarkable resilience. I read Silenced Voices nearly at one setting. Having worked with Guatemalan groups during the time the story is set, I approached the book with a kind of implicit checklist. For example, would it mention the United States' role in the repression? The Israeli role, which was large? Would it have a credible account of the guerrilla movement in opposition to the military and Guatemalan elite? While these aren't major themes in the novel, they are present and handled fairly. As I said, I was moved by the story. The only thing I thought the author got wrong was his one-sentence assertion that the resistance movement won in the 1990s. In fact, winning, and losing are often ambiguous in real life. My sense is that the movement's participation in negotiations in the mid-1990s and in the ineffective truth and reconciliation process was rather a result of the movement's weakness. But I thought it fine to end the book with that sense of hope rather than ambiguous defeat. But that misrepresentation raises the significant question of what we mean by truth, especially when teachers using these books in the classroom are subject to so many pressures to teach a sanitized, mythologized version of history. Is it enough of a response to teach, quote, what really happened? And what do we mean anyway by what really happened? When we return to look at the second book written for middle schoolers, Shift Happens by J. Albert Mann, different understandings of truth and what we should mean by that word will be one of our points of emphasis.
Con cabellos largos, huipiles blancos, bajo la noche de luna nueva creciente, llena menguante. Ella se mostró. Algunos por los pueblos la ven caminar, han visto su rostro, cicatrizado está. Hay quienes le temen, le creen sobrenatural, pero su historia les quiero contar.
That was La Ciguanaba by Guatemalan indigenous artist Sara Curuchich, whose work features indigenous rights and struggles in Guatemala. We now return to Norm Diamond's commentary.
Hi again. I'm reviewing two books that I was asked to evaluate for their possible use in middle school classes. The first, Silenced Voices, by Pablo León, was a graphic novel that began with the experience of Guatemalan immigrants in the U.S., but traced that present experience to the political struggles of older generations back in their homeland. The second book is an ambitious labor history of the United States, Shift Happens, by J. Albert Mann. Before turning to its specifics, I want to note how remarkable I find its intention, teaching the story of work and workers to 11, 12, and 13-year-olds. Do children of that age have the ability to understand complex social and political issues? Until recently, that capacity was in doubt. In fact, I once debated Herbert Marcuse, icon of the 1960s radical movement, on precisely that question. The setting was the living room of a mutual friend, and Marcuse was being dismissive of working politically with anyone younger than college students. I challenged him, not out of any experience I had, but just out of logic. He argued what the psychology of that time claimed, that children grew their understanding of the world in enlarging concentric circles. First, the child's world was restricted to the mother's breast, then the immediate family, the neighborhood, the community, etc. And only by college age could young adults have much grasp of the larger world and its forces. My response was that psychology was flawed by being restricted to the empirical. Psychologists were testing children for what they understood now, but neither they nor the education system were attempting to push the accepted boundaries. We couldn't know children's potential, the limits of their capabilities, I argued, until we had actually tried to expand those limits. I think I won the debate on logical grounds, but it's teachers and students across the country, very much including the groups that sent me the books to review, that have turned that potential that once was hidden into what's now empirical reality. It no longer surprises us that students of high school age or younger can take stands against racism, or in protection of the environment, or in support of immigrant classmates. And that issue of potential as its own form of reality brings us back to the theme with which we ended part one of these Old Mole reviews this morning. Beyond, quote, what actually happened, potential, too, is an aspect of what we mean by truth. Shift Happens has a lot of qualities that make it suitable for youngsters. Short chapters, lively accounts, good use of illustrative anecdotes. Whether the language is appropriate, it uses words I can't say on the air, like the vaguely scatological reference in the book's title, I leave to others closer to that age group. Politically, it has important strengths. It explicitly relates past history to present challenges. Its understanding of labor history casts a wider net that is true in many other books on the subject. For example, linking U.S. military attacks on the Russian Revolution in its early days with government attacks on worker movements here, or correctly treating the U.S. Electoral College as a weapon against workers as part of class struggle. It shows how arguments used by capital now recycle the same motifs from the past. It identifies capitalism as the underlying problem throughout. There are also, however, problems with the book, including some things it gets plain wrong. The AFL was not a union, but a federation of unions, an unfortunately common mistake by people outside the labor movement, but one that bespeaks unfamiliarity with the author's subject. Her one-sentence reference to the great and formative West Coast longshore strike in 1934 dismisses it as a loss. This is an egregious dismissal of a victory that both shaped Portland and had national resonance. Apparently, she's not read my own co-authored The Power in Our Hands, which has an entire unit on that strike. She says Muhammad Ali served 3 years in jail for draft resistance. In fact, he was sentenced, but served not a day. More subtly, that is, not exactly wrong, but wrong in a way that has vast importance, her account of the so-called timber wars here in the Pacific Northwest and Northern California presents that particular labor-environmental struggle as a straightforward loss for the environmentalists. Having been part of that struggle, my emphasis would be on how the labor-environmental movement grew as a result, even as the trees ended up clear-cut, how it brought some workers and environmentalists closer together, enlarging the perspectives of both, how it forced protective legislation, not simply a loss. Teachers are under a great deal of pressure now to impose a distorted and idealized version of U.S. history, one that departs from the facts. But facts are contentious. Interpretations differ, as we've seen even with this working-class sympathetic text. When we return with part three of this morning's book reviews, I want to delve more deeply into this labor history for middle schools, and what we mean by truth and teaching truth.
In the year 2002, with only 20 minutes warning, the liberals introduced Bill 29. Only 3 days later, that hateful bill was passed. It offered BC workers bitter wine. The layoffs and the closings took their toll on patient care, with loyal workers laid off and locked out. With our collective bargaining rights denied by act of law,
Our union's very future was in doubt. But we fought back,
we fought back,
we fought back and we won. Oh, we fought back,
we fought back,
we fought back and we won.
That was a clip from the song We Fought Back by Rebel Voices. Now, here's the final part of Norm Diamond's commentary on teaching truth.
Back again for the third and final part of this morning's Book Mole Reviews. Part one was about a well-done graphic novel on the struggle of Mayan people in Guatemala, especially in the 1980s, and its relation to their immigration to the U.S. now. Part two began a review of Shift Happens, A Labor History for Middle Schoolers by J. Albert Mann. We left off with the meaning of truth when it comes to teaching history. An important element of what teachers mean by teaching truth is teaching how to understand a society. We look at history not only for inspiration or to validate our sense of grievance, but also to learn things like how to figure out who might be potential allies in our present struggles, and how to assess strengths and weaknesses in the structures that maintain what we want to change. One strength of Shift Happens is its inclusive sense of who workers are, including farmers, slaves, artisans, etc. A serious weakness in the book is its repeated generalizations that group the entire class as if there weren't and aren't differences of perspective or differences in perceived interests within the class. The author has U.S. workers as a whole sympathizing with the Russian Revolution. According to her, U.S. workers knew about and understood U.S. trade policies. The poor understood the myths they were being fed, etc. Similar generalizations about undifferentiated groups within the class, for instance, about white worker radicalism, implying all white workers, obscure important distinctions and forego opportunities to teach strategic analysis. Perhaps as a result, her chapter on the post-World War II Treaty of Detroit between the Auto Workers Union and the Big Three auto companies misses the crucial point that the so-called treaty marked a shift in the union from a class-wide perspective to advocacy for UAW union members alone. Similarly, her detailed account of the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act leaves out what may be its most important consequence, that the legislation bans sympathy strikes, bans the most meaningful solidarity actions one union can take on behalf of another. When the author does offer explanations, as distinct from simply narrating events, they are often too simplistic. Her objective seems more to shock students out of complacency, a good but limited goal, rather than to teach ways of thinking and modes of analysis. She explains the development of wage labor, for instance, by a single factor, that it is cheaper for economic elites to pay wages than it would be to house and feed people they've enslaved. This indeed was and is a factor, but hardly the only one. Another factor a teacher might consider mentioning in this context, of course, is that enslaved people can be harder to control, have a long history of resisting. Shift Happens treats democracy throughout as an unproblematic concept, as if what is called by that name in our country is the only form conceivable. The author treats Communist Party organizers in the labor movement fairly, but she accepts the anti-communist slur that equates communism as a vision for the future with what happened only in the Soviet Union. She does this through her definition of communism strictly and narrowly as state control of the economy. By contrast, consider Karl Marx on the vision of a transformed society, not simply an economy, in which the state as an institution has withered away. You know that quote about the state withering. There are unreconciled emphases throughout the book, On the one hand, the author shows lots of resistance, even revolts, by workers. On the other hand, the overall tone is one of victimization. As a result, I was not left with a convincing sense of hope. As with her account of the timber wars, a more nuanced understanding of activism, both its costs and how to measure success, is called for. She does offer a more balanced assessment of one form of activism, strikes in workplaces, both encouraging the tactic by showing multiple historic wins and simultaneously cautioning about the price paid by strike participants. Similarly, the understanding of the state which she presents is not coherent. Often she portrays it as nothing more than an agent of the ruling class, seeming to discourage making demands on it. But other times, she recounts successful working class pressures on the state, and even advocates for participation in electoral politics. Here, too, a nuanced summation of what she thinks we've learned from the history would have been useful for students considering activism. It also might have prevented other egregious and misleading history mistakes, like treating the right of California agricultural workers to organize as nothing more than a gift from the governor. Gaining that right was, of course, very much also an outcome of workers' willingness to defy the law that banned organizing and organize in spite of the law's prohibitions. Along the same lines, she is inconsistent in drawing lessons about whether working-class movements should aim at stricter regulations on capital or at getting rid of capital entirely. At various points, she implies both. This is a set of issues that teachers could use to highlight dilemmas we face in attempting to be actors in history and to model a more strategic level of thinking. Tougher regulations, for instance, might actually reinforce capital and enable it to persist, as happened with the New Deal. Conversely, it might be possible to organize, and should be possible, actually, to organize for greater regulation now, but to do so in a way that builds a movement toward abolishing capital entirely. There's a difference, of course, between what a book offers in itself and what a prepared teacher might bring to it, a difference between the text's limitations and how a creative teacher might transcend them. I've tried to suggest that we need to go well beyond the notion of truth as limited to accuracy about what really happened, what really occurred. In other words, what happened empirically. Potential is equally a form of reality and can be analyzed and understood. From that perspective, we learn that thoughtful strategy could have made a difference at crucial points in history. We, as well as students, can see that the society we have now was not inevitable, and that it could develop in different directions in the future. We can draw on history to learn how to analyze our own society, how to understand its potential for change, and see the alternative paths it offers. Most of all, we can see that the alternatives can be influenced by our present actions. I've been talking about two books written for middle schoolers that are worth our attention as adults: Silenced Voices by Pablo León and Shift Happens by J. Albert Mann. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour.